Hello, this is Brian, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 18th issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. U.S. and Canada hold last-minute talks to stop Trump's 50% tariffs. The U.S. and Canada are negotiating in an effort to reach a truce on tariffs before a 12:01 a.m. Wednesday deadline set by U.S. President Donald Trump. If no deal is reached, Trump has threatened to impose 50% tariffs on $20 billion worth of Canadian products, ranging from hockey sticks to tongue depressors. "We are negotiating," Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney told reporters Monday, speaking in French. "The negotiations are very intense and delicate. This is not the time to talk about negotiations in public." Carney and Trump spoke by phone Monday afternoon about the ongoing trade negotiations, Carney's office said, underscoring the last-minute push to reach a deal before Wednesday's deadline. "The two countries have wrangled for decades over trade, poking each other over sore spots like Canadian softwood lumber imports and U.S. access to Canada's protected dairy market. Somehow, they still managed to remain friends, allies, and trading partners. Canadian soldiers fought alongside Americans in Afghanistan after 9/11. The 5,525-mile U.S.-Canada border is undefended, and nearly 330,000 people and $2 billion worth of goods cross it every day. 800,000 Canadians live in the United States." Trump's approach to dealing with Canada marks an extraordinary departure from the traditionally cooperative relationship between the two countries. Trump has hit Canadian goods with tariffs in a push to bring manufacturing back to the United States, and has repeatedly made inflammatory comments about turning Canada into America's 51st state. "The Canadian public is fed up. A petition to expel the U.S. ambassador, a Trump ally, has collected nearly 218,000 signatures since July 21st. It accuses Ambassador Pete Hoekstra of having normalized Trump's talk of annexing Canada, among other things. Looking for an off-ramp, nearly 72% of Canada's goods exports last year went to the United States, and the Trump administration might be wary of imposing a hefty new tariff paid by U.S. importers who try to pass along the cost to consumers via higher prices ahead of November's midterm elections. American voters are already frustrated with the high cost of living. I don't think either side really wants these tariffs to come into effect," said Ryan Majerus, a partner at King & Spalding and a former U.S. trade official. "There's a pretty strong push on both sides to find an off-ramp here." Majerus said the United States is aiming to get Canada to buy more U.S. military equipment, including F-35 fighters, to take part in Trump's Golden Dome missile defense, and to give the United States more access to critical minerals, thereby reducing America's reliance on tenuous supplies from its geopolitical rival, China. "The Canadians would like relief from U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum, as well as softwood lumber, which America says receives unfair government subsidies." Trump relies on Smoot-Hawley to go after Canada. Trump has made tariffs the centerpiece of his second-term economic agenda. Last year, he imposed double-digit import taxes on almost every country on Earth, justifying them by declaring the long-standing U.S. trade deficit a national emergency. The Supreme Court in February ruled that he'd overstepped his authority, striking down those tariffs and setting the stage for the federal government to pay refunds to importers. Trump immediately looked for other ways to rebuild his tariff wall. Last month, he imposed import taxes of 10% to 12.5% on 59 countries and the European Union, which together account for 99% of U.S. imports, for allegedly failing to have or to enforce restrictions on imports made from forced labor. Then he reached back to the Great Depression to find a cudgel with which to whack Canada, one of his favorite targets. Trump invoked Section 338 of the Tariff Act of 1930 to impose 50% tariffs on products that account for about 5% of Canadian exports to the United States. Nearly a century ago, with the U.S. and world economies in collapse, Congress passed the 1930 tariff law, imposing hefty taxes on imports from around the world. Known as the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, named for their congressional sponsors, they are notorious among economists and historians for limiting world commerce and making the Great Depression worse. Section 338 tariffs have never been used before. U.S. trade negotiators traditionally have favored another tool, Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, the provision Trump invoked to impose last month's forced labor tariffs. Section 338 authorizes the president to impose tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries that have discriminated against U.S. businesses. Unlike Section 301 sanctions, no investigation is required, nor is there any limit on how long the tariffs can stay in place. In announcing the Section 338 tariffs, Trump claimed that Canada discriminates against American exports of autos, alcohol, and cheese. Trump is angry because Canada and China were the only countries that punched back with retaliatory tariffs of their own when he slapped levies on their products last year. If a country retaliates against us, we're obviously not going to tolerate that, U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer told reporters Friday at the Iowa State Fair. We'll take action. My sense is the Canadians, they want to have a more conciliatory approach, but we'll see. New leverage to renegotiate USMCA. The U.S. is renegotiating a North American trade pact, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, that Trump strong-armed America's neighbors into accepting in his first term. The threat of Section 338 tariffs gives the United States leverage to seek fresh concessions from Ottawa. From Carney's perspective, you need USMCA to be renegotiated, said Christopher Gunderman, a fellow in the economics program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can't renegotiate it with a massive trade war going on. But the Canadian public's furor over Trump's policies may limit Carney's ability to cut a deal. Canada could retaliate again if the new 50% tariffs take effect, potentially aggravating a trade fight. Canada's government cannot look like it is simply caving to the Trump administration's demands, said Daniel Belland, a political science professor at McGill University in Montreal. Making further concessions without getting something meaningful in exchange would probably lead to a strong backlash. The risk is for the Carney government to make Canada look weak and therefore even more vulnerable to future trade and geopolitical bullying on the part of the Trump administration. Dominic LeBlanc, Canada's Minister for U.S. Trade, met with Greer on Monday. He was tight-lipped afterward. The work is continuing, he said. We continue to do our job. Trump says U.S. has no talks planned with Iran, and other news from the Middle East. U.S. President Donald Trump said Tuesday the U.S. has no talks planned with Iran, but insisted the Strait of Hormuz remains open and operating despite limited traffic and a reported strike on a ship exiting the waterway. Earlier this week, Trump also threatened to bomb Oman as the country sought a deal with Iran to manage shipping traffic through the strait, two regional officials said Tuesday, a day after Trump leveled the threat. Iran says the waterway will not be reopened until the U.S. meets its conditions. As talks between Iran and Oman continue, a projectile hit a ship in the strait, and Iran-backed Houthi rebels claimed they fired drones at an oil refinery in Saudi Arabia. Here's a look at the latest developments Tuesday in the Iran war and the wider Middle East. Full coverage can be found here. Trump looms over negotiations to reopen Strait of Hormuz. As Oman and Iran say they are nearing a deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, Trump said on social media Tuesday that the U.S. blockade of Iranian ports remains in full force and effect, and asserted that all water mines have been removed. Trump posted a map depicting the strait as U.S. territory. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Kazem Gharibabadi appeared to respond to Trump's post. Just as Trump correctly wrote the name of the eternal Persian Gulf, soon his delusion regarding the Strait of Hormuz will either be corrected, or we will correct the delusions of this deluded man, he wrote on X. The Trump administration has told Oman it opposes parts of the yet-to-be-announced deal, according to officials briefed on the U.S. position. Those include joint Iranian and Omani management of the passage's exit route and the collection of voluntary fees from vessels, even if the money is used for security and maritime environmental protection. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to talk to journalists. The White House on Tuesday referred to Trump's remarks in the Oval Office and declined to comment further about Oman. Egypt says Iran-Oman agreement could open door to Iran-U.S. deal. The Egyptian Foreign Ministry said Tuesday that the Iranian-Omani deal could pave the way for Washington and Tehran to return to negotiations for a comprehensive and permanent deal that addresses all concerns and enhances regional security and stability. The statement came after a meeting between Egyptian Foreign Minister Badr Abdulati and Omani counterpart Badr al-Busaidi, but it did not address Trump's latest threat against Oman. The 60-day negotiating period ended this week because the U.S. and Iran with no clear end to the war in sight. Ship traffic drops significantly in Strait of Hormuz. Ship traffic through the Strait of Hormuz dropped significantly last week, with confirmed crossings falling 19.5% to 95 transits. Only three vessels made it through the waterway on Sunday, according to shipping data platform Kepler. The ships use the Iranian designated route, with no crossings recorded through the Omani routes. Crossings through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait increased 6.7% to 254 transits, while so-called dark transits, in which ships turn off the transponders that broadcast their location, fell from 40 to 16, Kepler said. Projectile damages ship and strait, causing casualty. An unidentified projectile damaged the engine room of a ship in the Strait of Hormuz near Oman and resulted in a crew casualty, according to the British military's UK Maritime Trade Operations Center. The Maritime Monitoring Agency did not release any details about the ship or its cargo, and it was not clear whether the crew member was killed or wounded. No environmental damage has been reported, and the agency said the Omani Coast Guard was assisting other crew members and authorities were investigating. Iran-backed Houthis claim an attack on a Saudi oil refinery. Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi rebels claim they fired drones at an oil refinery in neighboring Saudi Arabia, the latest attack threatening to reignite Yemen's civil war and open another front in the Middle East. The attack targeted a facility run by Saudi Aramco, Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil company, according to a report by the Houthi-run Sabah News Agency. There were no immediate reports of damage or comment from Saudi Arabia. The Houthis have escalated attacks against government forces in Yemen and oil facilities in Saudi Arabia, which supports the Yemeni government and the kingdom's shipping in the Red Sea. an important alternative to the Strait of Hormuz. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Senator presses Hegseth Kane for commitment to keep U.S. military out of the midterm elections. Michigan Senator Alyssa Slotkin asked Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth on Tuesday to confirm he won't send U.S. troops to polling places during November's midterm elections, as Democrats have raised concerns that the Trump administration could use the military to interfere with the vote. I'd ask you to confirm a simple statement. The Department of Defense will not send federal troops to the polls or to seize election materials of any kind, Slotkin wrote to Hegseth and to General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in letters Tuesday. The Pentagon said in an email that it will respond directly to Slotkin, as it does with all congressional correspondence. The Joint Chiefs did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Slotkin told the Associated Press that Trump has been laying the groundwork to claim the midterms were stolen. She noted that Trump contemplated using the military to seize voting machines after his loss in 2020 and has deployed the National Guard to cities against the wishes of Democratic leaders. He also deployed active duty Marines to Los Angeles during his immigration crackdown in 2025. He's very clearly laying the breadcrumbs to be able to say the day after the election that he didn't really lose the House or he didn't really lose the Senate, Slotkin said. Slotkin asked Hegseth during an April congressional hearing if he would follow orders to seize ballots. Hegseth called the question a gotcha hypothetical, but said, "I've never been ordered to do anything illegal, and I won't." White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles denied in a Vanity Fair interview last year that Trump would use the military to suppress voting in the midterms. "I say it is categorically false, will not happen. It's just wrong-headed," she said. Federal law prohibits the deployment of armed federal forces to election locations unless necessary to repel armed enemies of the United States. If any element of the military were to get involved, it would likely be the National Guard under state control. In 2020, Senator Mark Milley, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, responded to a similar letter from Slotkin, then a congresswoman. "I believe deeply in the principle of an apolitical U.S. military," Miley wrote. "In the event of dispute over some aspect of the elections, by law, U.S. courts and the U.S. Congress are required to resolve any disputes, not the U.S. military." The Moscow region is hit by a drone blitz as Russian missiles kill 10 in a Ukrainian village. Ukrainian forces launched one of their biggest drone attacks on Russia since Moscow's invasion over 4 years ago, firing almost 800 drones in only 2 days after a similar salvo, officials said Tuesday. Meanwhile, a Russian missile strike on a village in northeastern Ukraine's Kharkiv region killed at least 10 people and wounded 17 others as the barrage demolished homes, officials said. The countries are locked in an escalating duel of long-range aerial strikes. Fighting on the roughly 780-mile front line in eastern and southern Ukraine is restricted by large numbers of drones and ground robots threatening troop movements, and neither side is making significant battlefield progress, analysts say. Putin resists pressure for peace talks. In the past year, Ukraine has devised and deployed domestically produced long-range drones for strikes deep inside Russia. Its drone technology has impressed governments and defense manufacturers around the world. Officials in Kiev aim to make the Russian public feel the war's consequences and pressure Russian President Vladimir Putin into negotiating a peace settlement. Putin has so far shown no signs he intends to stop the invasion. Putin continues to drag out the war instead of accepting Ukraine's realistic ceasefire proposals and ending the bloodshed, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Andriy Sybiha said in a post on X. Russian air defenses overnight intercepted 791 Ukrainian drones over a number of regions, as well as annexed Crimea and the Black and the Azov Seas, the defense ministry in Moscow said, in what was the second largest drone attack since January 2025, according to an Associated Press tally. More than 600 Ukrainian drones flew toward the Moscow region, where 180 were shot down, Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin said without elaborating. Officials reported no deaths or major damage. Ukraine has increasingly launched swarms of hundreds of drones to try to overwhelm Russian air defenses. In the region that surrounds the capital, three people were wounded, Governor Andrei Voroboyev said. Three people were also wounded in the adjacent Ryazan region, where three private houses were damaged, Governor Pavel Malkov said. The overnight attack started a fire at a warehouse of Wildberries, Russia's biggest online retailer in an industrial zone. Ukraine has repeatedly targeted the company, which it says helped supply the Russian military, an allegation Moscow denies. Wildberries said its facility sustained insignificant damage. Russian TV doesn't report news of the attack. Coverage of the attack in state and Kremlin-backed Russian media was mostly muted, as is often the case. Russia's main TV channels, state-run Russia 1 and Channel 1, did not mention the attack at all in their morning news bulletins. But Russian state news agency RIA Novosti featured it among the main news on its website's homepage, describing it as one of the most large-scale attacks on Moscow since the beginning of the summer. State newspaper Rossiyskaya Gazeta on its website prominently featured a roundup of what Moscow regional government Andrei Voroboyev reported about the attack, describing it as massive in the headline. Pro-Kremlin tabloid MK featured a news brief about it on its homepage. Zelensky accuses Russia of a brutal attack on civilians. A Russian missile strike on the village of Bychnihi in Ukraine's Kharkiv region killed 10 civilians, according to preliminary information, said Oleh Sinyabohov, head of the Kharkiv Regional Military Administration. Another 17 people were wounded, he said. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called it a brutal attack that damaged 10 homes, a cafe, a post office, a store, and at least 7 vehicles, according to Sinyabohov. We will definitely respond to this Russian strike, he said on social media. Also, 3 people were killed and 3 others were wounded over the past day in Russian attacks on Ukraine's Sumy region, Ukraine's national police said. UK vows continued Ukraine support. British Prime Minister Andy Burnham, who took office last month, said the UK will continue to stand by Ukraine after Russia said that Kiev's reported use of British drones for attacks on Russian soil would bring unidentified consequences. We are providing support so that Ukraine can defend itself. That's been the British position all the way through this conflict by previous prime ministers, Burnham said. It remains the case with me. British newspaper The Sunday Times reported that 2 UK companies made drones used by Ukraine to hit Russia. Following the report, the Russian embassy in the UK said in a statement that London's actions will inevitably carry consequences. UN watchdog excavates suspected Syrian nuclear site as Damascus pledges safeguards. Inspectors with the United Nations nuclear watchdog have begun excavating at a site believed to be linked to a clandestine nuclear program run by Syria's former government, the agency's chief said on Thursday. The announcement came as Syria's new government has pledged to cooperate with the watchdog. Syria's top diplomat said Thursday that Damascus remains interested in developing a peaceful nuclear program and intends to keep any nuclear material in its custody under international safeguards. Under former President Bashar Assad, Syria was believed to have operated an extensive undeclared nuclear program that included a nuclear reactor built by North Korea in eastern Deir ez-Zor province. Syria, under Assad, allowed IAEA inspectors to visit some sites, but the country under interim President Ahmad al-Shara has pledged full cooperation with the UN watchdog and given its inspectors access to suspected nuclear sites. Myself and my team, we were inside the site of Deir ez-Zor, where very comprehensive work of excavation and exploration is taking place now, the International Atomic Energy Agency's Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi said at a news conference in Damascus. Grossi said another site with nuclear material has also been discovered, but did not disclose any details. Grossi said Syria's cooperation has enormous importance. We're talking about a few tons of nuclear material that could be put to bad use, and Syria has decided to open up the site to the inspectors of the IAEA, Grossi said. This material will be accounted for and will be put within the international safeguard system. Syria, under its new leadership, has expressed an intention to develop nuclear energy. Syria confirms, based on technical evaluations, that this material does not pose any danger, Syrian Foreign Minister Assad al-Shibani said. It will remain in Syria's custody and will remain subject to the agency's safeguard system. The site in Deir ez-Zor only became public knowledge after Israel launched airstrikes in 2007 that destroyed the facility. Syria later leveled the site and never responded fully to the IAEA's questions about it. However, in 2024, before Assad was deposed in December of that year, IAEA inspectors took samples at three locations, and in 2025, said they had found traces of uranium at one site. Israel is believed to be the Middle East's only state with nuclear weapons, although it has not declared its own program. Russia summons Japanese envoy following Putin's visit to disputed islands. Russia's foreign ministry on Tuesday summoned the Japanese ambassador to protest Tokyo's condemnation of President Vladimir Putin's trip to the Kuril Islands, the Moscow-controlled Pacific archipelago that is claimed by both countries. Last week, Putin visited Iturup, one of the four southernmost islands of the chain, which Japan calls the Northern Territories. The Soviet Union took them from Japan in the final days of World War II, and the dispute has kept the countries from signing a peace treaty, formally ending their hostilities. Japan's Prime Minister, Sane Takashi, said Putin's visit, his first to the islands, was incompatible with the Japanese position on the Northern Territories and was absolutely unacceptable. She said the visit was a further blow to already strained ties between the two countries over Ukraine and that Moscow should understand the consequences. Japanese Foreign Minister Toshimitsu Motegi said Tokyo strongly protests Putin's visit to Iturup, which Japan calls Iturufu, noting that the Northern Territories, including Iturufu Island, are Japan's inherent territory both historically and from the perspective of international law. On Tuesday, Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Galuzin met with Japanese Ambassador Ikira Muto to lodge a formal protest over the anti-Russia statements by Takachi and Motegi. Russia's sovereignty and jurisdiction over the southern Kuril Islands are absolutely unshakable, Galuzin told Mutu, according to the foreign ministry. These territories passed to our country as a result of World War II that was enshrined in the relevant agreements of the Allied powers and the UN Charter, the ministry said. Any attempts by the Japanese side to directly or indirectly call this obvious reality into question are absolutely unacceptable and unlawful. Galuzin told the ambassador that in view of Tokyo's adherence to Western sanctions against Russia and its support for Ukraine, Moscow reserves the right to take appropriate countermeasures. The Japanese embassy said in a statement that Mutu, during his approximately 20-minute meeting with Galuzin, appropriately explained the Japanese position on the Northern Territories and President Putin's recent visit. It gave no other details, including how Mutu responded to Galuzin's comment on Russia's territorial claim of the islands, or if Japan is considering taking a retaliatory step, citing the sensitivity of the issue. Decades of diplomatic efforts to negotiate a settlement haven't produced any visible results. Moscow over the years has also bolstered its military presence on the Kurils in moves that appeared to underscore its firm stance in the dispute. Speaking last week aboard a Russian warship taking part in the drills in the Pacific, Putin said Moscow previously had developed constructive relations with a number of Japanese leaders, including the tragically deceased former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who did much to bring Japan and Russia closer together to align our positions. Japan imposed sanctions on Russia after it sent troops into Ukraine in February 2022 and listed Russia as a source of primary threats, a change in that constructive relationship, he said. Russia remains ready to cooperate with all its neighbors, including Japan and other states in the region, Putin said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. ABC sues FCC over a challenge to its broadcast licenses, saying actions present existential threat. Further escalating its battle with the Trump administration, ABC on Tuesday took the rare step of suing the Federal Communications Commission on First Amendment grounds, saying the agency's demand for early review of broadcast licenses posed an existential threat to its operations. In the lawsuit, ABC, its parent company Disney, and the 8 local stations whose licenses are affected asked a federal court to stop the early renewal proceedings. The FCC, under Chairman Brendan Carr, an ally of President Donald Trump, had ordered the early review in April, itself a rare move, of 8 licenses owned by ABC, well before they are set to expire. It cited the network's diversity practices as a reason, but the development came shortly after a joke by ABC's late-night host Jimmy Kimmel, an outspoken Trump critic, had infuriated the president. Again and again, the administration has attacked ABC's speech, the stories its journalists report, and the viewpoints its network programs air, the network alleged in its lawsuit. Over time, those attacks have escalated into express demands that ABC be stripped of its broadcast licenses because of its speech. Facing this existential threat, it added, plaintiffs have no choice but to seek redress from the judicial branch for the administration's blatant retaliation for their First Amendment speech. It said ABC had no alternative means to eliminate these ongoing and immediate threats other than total capitulation to the administration's demands. It asked the court to immediately enjoin defendants from taking or threatening to take any action against plaintiffs in relation to the early license renewal applications. There are already clashes between ABC and the administration. The early license review is only one part of a long simmering confrontation between ABC and the FCC. The network has also been fighting Carr's efforts to make the morning talk show The View, whose hosts and guests are often critical of Trump, subject to equal time rules. That's a question ABC says the agency itself decided in the network's favor more than 2 decades ago. The lawsuit Tuesday also spoke of ramifications that go well beyond one network. The consequences of the administration's campaign against free speech reach well beyond ABC, it said. If the administration gets its way, the message to every media company in the country will be unmistakable. Tell only the stories the administration deems favorable, or face the coercive machinery of the federal government. In such a world, the press could in no way be described as free. It added, the FCC chairman has left little doubt that this is his goal. The lone Democrat on the FCC praises the lawsuit. The sole Democrat on the commission, Ana Gomez, commended ABC and Disney for pushing back against the FCC's actions. For months, the FCC has waged a campaign of censorship and control against Disney's ABC stations, she said in a statement. Using the threat of broadcast license revocations to punish a company for speech this administration doesn't like. I have long called on companies to push back against this kind of government intimidation, and I'm glad Disney has shown courage and stepped up, she said. This should be a welcome sign for every broadcaster who has felt the weight of this overreaching government pressure and silence. In late July, Carr defended his agency's actions against ABC, saying broadcasters have a duty to operate in the public interest. The FCC, he said, was merely trying to restore that standard. Broadcasters like ABC, Carr said in an interview on the Fox Business Network, struck a deal with the American people. You broadcasters get subsidized access, free access to a valuable public resource, the airwaves worth billions of dollars. In exchange, you have to operate in the public interest. Look, as a country, we should have a trusted, respected news media, and we're not there, Carr said. So I hope more broadcasters return to their public interest obligations. The FCC did not immediately respond to a request for comment Tuesday. Trump threatened to bomb Oman because he's unhappy with the country's deal with Iran, officials say. U.S. President Donald Trump threatened to bomb Oman because he is unhappy the country is close to a deal with Iran to manage ship traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, two regional officials said Tuesday, a day after Trump leveled the threat. The officials said the Trump administration has told Oman it is opposed to parts of the yet-to-be-announced deal, including the joint Iranian and Omani management of the exit route out of the passage that's critical to global supplies of oil and natural gas. The officials were briefed on the U.S. position and how the administration views Oman's position. Meanwhile, projectile hit a ship as it sailed out of the strait, according to the British military's Maritime Monitoring Agency, and an Iranian official said the waterway would not reopen until the United States meets Iran's conditions. The Defense Ministry of the United Arab Emirates said two ballistic missiles were launched from Iran toward the UAE. U.S. believes Oman has not been tough enough with Iran. The U.S. believes Oman has not been tough enough in its negotiations with Iran and is unhappy with Oman's agreement to collect voluntary fees from vessels, even if the charges are related to security and maritime environmental protection, according to the officials, who spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to talk to journalists. Trump on Monday threatened to bomb Oman as it works with Iran on a deal to open the strait and pave the way for the U.S. and Iran to resume negotiations to end the war. He posted a map on social media Tuesday depicting the strait as U.S. territory. The president first mentioned the idea in an offhand comment last week. On Monday, he told reporters in the Oval Office, "I like the idea of declaring it a territory," without providing details. The White House on Tuesday referred to Trump's remarks in the Oval Office and declined to comment further about Oman. Iran refers to Trump's delusion about the strait. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Qasem Gharibabadi appeared to respond to Trump's posts on social media depicting the strait as American territory. Just as Trump correctly wrote the name of the eternal Persian Gulf, his delusion regarding the Strait of Hormuz will soon either be corrected or we will correct this deluded man's delusions for him, Garababadi wrote on X. Trump's comment on Monday was not the first time he has threatened Oman. In May, he told reporters during a cabinet meeting that Oman will behave just like everybody else, or we will have to blow them up. Iran reiterated Tuesday that Tehran plans to maintain its grip on shipping and traffic until Washington meets its conditions. Until the United States fulfills its commitments under the agreement, including lifting the blockade, releasing frozen assets, lifting oil sanctions, ending threats and military operations on all fronts, and implementing the other conditions to which it committed, the Strait of Hormuz will not reopen, said Mohammad Mubarak Kolobov, Iran's parliamentary speaker and negotiator in previous talks with the U.S. The Egyptian Foreign Ministry said Tuesday that the Iranian-Omani deal could pave the way for Washington and Tehran to return to negotiations for a comprehensive and permanent deal that addresses all concerns and enhances regional security and stability. The statement came after a meeting between Egyptian Foreign Minister Badr Abdulati and Omani counterpart Badr al-Busaidi, but it did not address Trump's latest threat against Oman. President insists Strait is open as more attacks are reported. Trump said Tuesday the U.S. has no planned talks with Iran, but insisted the Strait is open and operating despite limited traffic, the reported boat strike, and the end on Monday of the 60-day negotiating period between the countries. Trump wrote on social media that a U.S. blockade of the Strait remains in full force and effect, adding that all water mines have been removed. As the talks between Oman and Iran continue, more attacks were reported in the region. One of the missiles fired at the UAE landed outside of the country's waters, and the other landed within them, the Emirati Defense Ministry said. It was unclear whether the missiles were shot down by air defenses or fell. No damages or injuries were reported. There was no immediate statement from Iran. In the weeks after the U.S. and Israel launched a war against Iran on February 28th, the UAE was frequently targeted by Iranian missiles and drones, but Tuesday's reported attack was the first in weeks. An unidentified projectile hit a ship early Tuesday in the Strait off the coast of Oman, damaging the engine room and causing a casualty, according to the UK Maritime Trade Operations Centre. The monitoring agency did not release any details about the ship or its cargo, and it was unclear whether the crew member was killed or wounded. The agency said the Omani Coast Guard was assisting other crew members and that authorities were investigating. And Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi rebels claimed they fired drones at an oil refinery in neighboring Saudi Arabia, the latest attack that threatened to reignite Yemen's civil war and open another front in the Middle East. The attack targeted a facility run by Saudi Aramco, Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil company, according to a report by the Houthi-run Sabah News Agency. There are no immediate reports of damage or comment from Saudi Arabia. Justice Department pushes to revive criminal case against Kilmar Abrego Garcia. The Justice Department is pushing to revive criminal charges against Kilmar Abrego Garcia, telling a federal appeals court late Monday that a judge erred in his scathing ruling that called the case against the man mistakenly deported to an El Salvadoran prison an abuse of prosecuting power. The government is appealing the May ruling by U.S. District Judge Waverly Crenshaw that threw up charges of human smuggling against the Salvadoran national. The ruling amounted to an extraordinary rebuke of a Justice Department that under President Donald Trump has repeatedly been accused of targeting defendants for political purposes. Crenshaw found that Abrego Garcia would never have faced criminal charges had he not successfully sued the government over his 2025 deportation. The ruling was an embarrassment for the Trump administration, which only brought him back after securing a criminal indictment against him. Crenshaw stopped short of finding the government acted with actual vindictiveness, a rarely met standard that usually requires evidence like a prosecutor admitting that charges were filed in retaliation against someone. But the judge did find there was enough evidence of presumptive vindictiveness that included the timing of the indictment. Homeland Security had been aware of the 2022 traffic stop in Tennessee that was the basis for the human smuggling charges for more than 2 years before Abrego Garcia was deported. The agency only reopened the case and began investigating in earnest after Abrego Garcia was ordered returned to the U.S. Crenshaw also found that statements by U.S. Attorney General Todd Lynch, who was a deputy at the time, suggested the Justice Department was targeting Abrego Garcia because he won his wrongful deportation case. In a brief filed Monday night with the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, federal prosecutors argued that Crenshaw got it wrong. Blanche's statements, they argue, demonstrated a legitimate motive for prosecuting him. His rationale reflected a normal assessment of the societal interest in punishment, not an improper penalty, they said. The statements explained that the government was seeking to protect the public and confirm its prior assertions about Abrego's criminal activity, the brief states. But even if Blanche's statements reflected an animus against Abrego Garcia, they are irrelevant because the person who actually brought the charges was then acting U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Tennessee, Rob McGuire, the brief states, rehashing an argument thoroughly rejected by Crenshaw that McGuire's motives were the only motives that mattered in the case. Crenshaw's ruling noted the sustained oversight of the case by top Justice Department officials, including regular communications between McGuire and Associate Deputy Attorney General Akash Singh, in finding that the criminal case was thoroughly tainted. Crenshaw also noted that prosecutors never called as a witness the investigator who actually reopened the case to explain why. Abrego Garcia, 31, is a Salvadoran citizen with an American wife and child who has lived in Maryland for years, although he immigrated to the U.S. illegally as a teenager. A 2019 order by an immigration judge prohibited his deportation to El Salvador, finding he had a well-founded fear of a gang that had targeted his family there. The judge allowed him to live and work in the U.S. under Immigration and Customs Enforcement supervision, but he was not given residency status. Blocked from re-deporting Abrego Garcia to El Salvador, the Trump administration has vowed to deport him to a third country, threatening to send him to Uganda, Eswatini, Ghana, and most recently, Liberia. Abrego Garcia has said he would agree to be deported to Costa Rica, which has said they will accept him, but the government has so far declined to send him there. He is fighting deportation to Liberia in a separate federal court case in Maryland. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Turkey's Erdogan signs law offering conditional pardon for thousands of PKK militants. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has signed into law a measure that would introduce a conditional pardon for thousands of Kurdish militants as part of a government peace effort with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. The measure was published in the Official Gazette on Tuesday. It will only come into force after Turkey's National Security Council confirms that the group has fully dissolved itself and disarmed. Parliament approved the bill overwhelmingly last week. It would suspend certain prison sentences for convicted PKK members and postpone ongoing investigations and trials against others for 5 or 10 years, depending on the severity of the crime. Authorities would drop the cases against the individuals if they don't reoffend during those periods. The legislation also establishes a committee to oversee the group's disarmament, with its first meeting expected next week. Last year, the PKK, considered a terrorist organization by Turkey and its Western allies, announced its decision to disband, following a call by its imprisoned leader, Abdullah Öcalan. Öcalan and other key PKK figures are excluded from the pardon. Soon after that, some fighters laid down their weapons in a symbolic ceremony in northern Iraq, where the group is based, and withdrew some fighters from key locations in Turkey to Iraq. The conflict with the PKK has killed tens of thousands of people since the 1980s. Hope reborn in Colombia as signs of life emerge under earthquake debris. Rescuers reported apparent signs of life under the rubble in two of the Colombian cities hit hardest by a massive earthquake, rekindling hopes Friday that more people could be found alive. Search and rescue teams from Venezuela, Argentina, and Israel joined the search for survivors following the 7.4 magnitude quake that struck the South American nation on Monday, killing at least 287 people. At 96 hours since the Temblor hit, the window for survival was narrowing Friday afternoon. The mayor of Pereira, Mauricio Salazar, told radio station FM on Friday that contact was made with a woman who was asking for help amid the rubble of a collapsed hotel at around 4 a.m. He suggested other people may have survived but were still trapped. Authorities in Cali also reported apparent signs of life, saying at least 3 people were trapped under collapsed buildings. The search and rescue effort has been extended through Saturday. Residents who lost their homes must start over again. With the overall search for survivors winding down, Colombia faced another challenge, rebuilding a nation shattered by a disaster that affected more than 100,000 people. Tens of thousands of houses were damaged or destroyed, according to the government. Authorities have also reported damage to thousands of schools, medical facilities, and community centers in more than 400 cities. "There is no place to live. We lost everything," Iber Jonathan Morales, 38, said Friday in a shelter in Cali. Morales is one of the 102,263 people whose lives were upended by the quake. The government says nearly 4,000 people were injured and hundreds remain missing. Private groups estimate the number of missing is in the thousands. Morales said he, his wife, and 4 children are trying to rebuild from scratch. The earthquake destroyed several neighborhoods in the city. Many houses were damaged and buildings collapsed, he said. "We are going to stay here until the government gives us some help, some support." The government focuses on providing shelter. The devastation has tested Colombia's president, Abelardo de la Espriella, who was inaugurated just days before the earthquake shook the country's west. De la Espriella acknowledged Thursday night that the situation is complex and announced a plan to partner with private companies to rebuild, as well as subsidies for families who are homeless. "We will not overcome this tragedy alone as government," he said. "We need the private sector to rebuild Colombia together." Monday's earthquake was the most powerful to hit Colombia this century. Government aid has yet to arrive in some areas where many people are relying on volunteers and neighbors for help. "A neighbor is giving me shelter," Olga Castro, mother of 5 in Cali, said. "At least we survived, but right now we are practically on the street because we don't have a home anymore." De la Espriella said national and international funds raised in response to the disaster will focus on the reconstruction of hospitals, schools, homes, roads, and airports. Rebuilding the country requires a serious technical assessment to determine which buildings can be used, which can be repaired, and which must be demolished and rebuilt, said Yazid Alvarado Vargas, a professor in construction engineering at Javeriana University in Bogota, Colombia. Before even discussing reconstruction, we must guarantee temporary housing, food, healthcare, continuity of basic services, and economic support for families who lost their homes or livelihoods, Alvarado said. In Bogota, Colombia's capital, around 500 volunteers gathered at a reception center to sort food, toiletries, and pet food before distributing the supplies in the most affected areas. From youngsters to the elderly, everyone diligently participated in the challenging relief efforts. We all have to help. Today is for you. Tomorrow might be for me, volunteer Jorge Munoz, 85, said, one of the oldest helpers at Bogota's Vive Claro aid collection. Munoz has witnessed the devastation caused by other earthquakes, including one in 1999 that killed more than 1,180 people. National and international aid keeps coming. Authorities have converted schools, parks, and public buildings into shelters, providing tents, mattresses, and food to the displaced. In other hard-hit cities, residents improvised shelters in the streets while hundreds of volunteers rushed to help those in need in hard-to-reach areas. These are isolated, neglected territories, historically lacking in institutional support, already plagued by violence, and now they are hit by an earthquake of this magnitude, said Maria Mercedes Livano, director of Save the Children in Colombia. It's a crisis on top of a crisis, leaving the population in a situation of extreme vulnerability, she added, citing communities including Buenaventura, the country's main port, and Choco, the earthquake's epicenter. Many buildings in Pereira have limited or no access to electricity and water, and volunteers have been delivering hygiene kits to displaced families in the city's shelters, said Pamela Londoño, a technical advisor with Project Hope. Of the five or six shelters in the city, at least one is already full and no longer accepting new residents. The nonprofit is also assessing medical supply needs. Other areas are also suffering, such as the town of Roldanillo, where approximately 60% of residents do not have access to clean water. The main concern is the lack of basic services for multiple communities, Londoño said. This is a really critical situation. De La Espria visited several cities to track relief efforts and aid distribution, including Quibdó in the Choco region and Pereira. Authorities are still waiting for tons of supplies and humanitarian aid from countries that have pledged their support, including Peru, China, the United States, and the United Arab Emirates. My heart, my strength, and my spirit are with all the victims and with all these territories that have been forgotten and now devastated by nature, he said. We must rebuild them. There is a great task ahead, and I am committed to it. The Trump administration announced Friday an additional $11 million in humanitarian aid, including food, health, protection, and shelter assistance, bringing the total U.S. assistance following the earthquake to $26.5 million. The U.S. continues to coordinate with Colombian President Abelardo de la Espria and the Colombian government to assess and respond to earthquake-related needs, the State Department said in a statement. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 18th issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Brian. Thank you for listening.